One of the biggest annoyances of summer in Wisconsin are the constant swarms of mosquitoes. Summer is short in the state, and while we're eager to get outside and enjoy those fleeting moments of beautiful weather, mosquitoes can have a way of forcing us back inside. Here, they're mostly just a nuisance, but our next guest says that throughout history, these pests have been a lot more deadly than we might think. Because they carry potentially fatal diseases, mosquitoes are responsible for the deaths of billions of humans throughout history, making them the deadliest predator of people that the world has ever seen. In a new book, our guest explains how mosquitoes have changed the course of human history from ancient times to present day. Timothy Weingart is a professor of history and political science at Colorado Mesa University and author of the new book, The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. Timothy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Well, what made you want to explore this topic that historians might not necessarily be expected to pursue?
Well, I look at history as a puzzle almost, and there were various pieces that fit together to make a clear picture of the devastation and historical influence of this tiny little animal throughout our existence and across our history. Part of my other books in military history and looking at indigenous people, my past four books, I kept coming across references to malaria specifically and yellow fever and dengue. So I was familiar with some of the devastation wrought by the mosquito. But as I got down the rabbit hole and started further into the research, it became very apparent. And as I said, fit more puzzle pieces together, just how influential this tiny creature and universal creature has been in steering the course of human history.
And you write that in military history and in other fields of history, the topic of disease and mosquito-borne disease in particular, it's often kind of overlooked or a footnote when in fact it should be, you say, front and center.
Well, yeah, up until the First World War, 65% of deaths during times of war were caused by disease. That included, obviously, malaria and yellow fever, depending on the wars and the campaigns, but also dysentery was a huge killer, influenza, smallpox, so various diseases. But people, journalists find, you know, disease rather dull when compared to our national supermen, which are most often legendary military heroes. So unfortunately, the history has been a bit tainted by, you know, ascribing victories or the rise and fall of empires and nations to human agency instead of outside factors. In this case, the mosquito has been paramount in dictating the course of numerous wars. And also the rise and fall of specific nations, including the United States.
Let's touch on the biology a little bit before we dig more into the history. When a mosquito lands on us, she is getting our blood. And it's always she, right?
Correct. Only females bite. The male's world essentially revolves around reproduction and nectar. The female, she's just doing what she's programmed to do, which is procreate and carry on her species. And she needs the blood of humans and a zoological Noah's Ark of other animals. It's not just humans. It's a wide variety of animals she needs blood from simply to grow and mature her eggs and do what she's programmed to do, which is procreate and carry on her species.
And with her comes a lot of diseases, of various forms, virus, bacteria, protozoa. Have evolved to use the mosquito as part of their own reproductive systems. Why is that? Why is the mosquito such a convenient vector for them?
Well, obviously, as you mentioned, Rob, the mosquito, untethered from a pathogen, is harmless. It's the pathogens that she transmits that are the killers and cause so much death and suffering and misery. So there's a host of viruses. There's three classes. There's viruses, worms, and then protozoan or malaria. The parasite is in its own class. So the virus class consists of yellow fever, dengue, Zika, West Nile, chikungunya, and a host of others. And then the worm category is filariasis, which causes the engorgement of limbs and genitals. And it's a worm that kind of blocks the lymph system in the lymph nodes, the filarial worm. And still 120 million people annually contract filariasis. Similar in canines, canine heartworm is actually caused by the mosquito as well. And then the parasite or protozoan class is malaria. And it's been the scourge of humanity across our existence. And it is the paramount killer, as well as yellow fever in the virus class. But thankfully, a vaccine was put forth in the 1930s for yellow fever. So only roughly 25,000 to 40,000 people still die of yellow fever annually, which is far less than it used to be thanks to the vaccine.
Talking to Timothy Weingard, author of the new book, The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. I want to go back to pre-human. We're newcomers here. The mosquito, you write, has been around for, what, 130 million years, and they were a nuisance and a cause of disease and possibly death for dinosaurs.
Yeah, depending on the estimates, the consensus is generally mosquitoes show up during the early Jurassic period, which is roughly 200 to 190 million years ago. Now, some estimates push them back as far as 225 million years ago, but regardless of the estimates, they were around during the reign of the dinosaurs. And prior to the meteor hitting our planet just outside the Yucatan Peninsula, leaving a crater the size of roughly Vermont, the state of Vermont, sandflies, mosquitoes, and other insects were feeding on dinosaurs for the same reasons they feed on animals today, to get blood to reproduce, and passing on viruses, worms, and parasites just like they do today. So it's theorized that roughly 70% of regional species on the planet, dinosaur species, were either extinct or endangered by the time the meteor actually hits, which essentially finishes them, the dinosaurs off.
And fast forwarding to humans, mosquitoes didn't just affect our history. We're going to spend more of our time on that. They actually shaped our evolution in some ways. We evolved in different places, different times, genetic reactions over generations to the diseases carried by mosquitoes.
Yeah, and what the, in Africa, with there's five kinds of malaria that affect humans, and the two most, I guess, prevalent in Africa and the most lethal are vivax and falciparum. So there's various genetic hereditary evolutionary responses that were essentially pushed forward by natural selection. Now, falciparum is the most deadly form of the five human malarias, and sickle cell was our response essentially through natural selection to combat what must have been such a survival pressure on our species, our early species in Africa, to have such a faulty evolutionary response, if you will. But what it speaks to is what must have been horrific and genocidal rates of falciparum malaria in Africa. So sickle cell, our red blood cells are generally oval or donut shaped. And sickle cell is a genetic mutation which makes our red blood cells sickle or crescent shaped. So the malaria parasite can't actually latch on to the blood cell. It fools it. It can't latch on to feed on the hemoglobin inside the blood cell and obviously giving us symptoms and making us sick. Now, the problem with sickle cell is it's a very hasty evolutionary response. If you inherit sickle cell from both parents, which is sickle cell disease, it's essentially a death sentence. And if you inherit sickle cell from one parent but a normal cell from the other, it's called sickle cell anemia or sickle cell trait. Now, it offers roughly a 90% shield against falciparum malaria, but at the same time, the average lifespan with sickle cell trait prior to modern medicine was about 23 years. But that's certainly long enough to procreate and carry on the human species and also pass on the sickle cell trait to your offspring. So it's a very hasty evolutionary response to what must have been cataclysmic death rates from falciparum malaria in Africa.
Well, let's get into the heart of your book now, The Mosquitoes and Human History. Alexander the Great conquered a lot of the known world. You say he stopped and ultimately maybe died because of mosquito-borne illness. Can you tell us about that
story? Well, when he crosses the Hindu Kush in Pakistan and continues east towards India, he starts his eastern push in the monsoon season along the Indus River Valley system. And mosquitoes had long been actually fingered by Indian physicians before that as a cause of disease. If not the mosquitoes, then the water that they bred in, according to the miasma theory. So it wasn't new that mosquitoes and malaria inhabited that area. So when he comes, towards that push into the east towards India, there's a few factors at play here. The rebellion or open mutiny of his troops is a little bit exaggerated. His troops were suffering from all sorts of diseases, including malaria. They'd been warring for years. They were tired. Alexander was more reliant on mercenaries by this point than he was on Greeks or Macedonians. And he had a perfect 20-0 battle record, and his next conquests were huge empires that had numerous war elephants that scared the Macedonian horses. So when his troops passed up their grievances up the chain of command and said they wanted to return west, he didn't appear to protest with any great zeal. And again, malaria was one factor in the decision in the weakening of Alexander's army in the Indus River system. And ultimately, he decided to turn back because of these compounding issues he was facing. And then on his way back, he stopped in Babylon to plan his campaigns, which included another eastern push. We don't know 100% because his body's gone missing, but the likely cause of Alexander's death is malaria. There's other causes that have been put forward, but malaria is the consensus. But we can't be 100% sure because his body is missing in action, essentially.
We continue our conversation with Timothy Weingard, professor of history and political science, author of the new book, The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the mosquito and how it's influenced human history? Have you ever been in a place that had a lot of malaria? Have you had malaria yourself? If you'd care to share the story, call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Timothy, you have chapters about American history there. Can you tell us how mosquito-borne illnesses, mainly malaria and yellow fever, affected the rise of slavery here in the United States?
Well, and initially when European colonizers come to the Americas, they need slave labor on their plantations, specifically in the Caribbean, but also in the lower American colonies as well. And so at first they tried to enslave indigenous peoples of the Americas, but the indigenous population, unfortunately, is not immune to these new European diseases that are brought with the Europeans. So upwards of 95 million of the 100 million indigenous peoples across the Western Hemisphere die within the first 200 years of Columbus, primarily of disease. So they're no longer really a feasible option for a slave labor economic system and a mercantilist system with these plantation colonies, specifically in the Caribbean, South Central America, and also the lower American colonies. So European indentured servants are then tried, but in these hot tropical places with mosquito-borne disease, they can't withstand the mosquito-borne disease. So part of the reason Africans are so valued in the Caribbean, which is a hotbed of malaria and yellow fever, is that they have, some of them have these genetic immunities to malaria, whether that be sickle cell, thalassemia, Duffy antigen negativity, and also they've been seasoned to yellow fever and survived yellow fever, which is a virus, in Africa itself, making them essentially inoculated or immune to yellow fever. So where indigenous peoples and European indentured servants are dying in droves in these furnace of mosquito-borne disease in the lower American South and the Caribbean, African slaves seem to withstand her wrath to more of an extent because of these hereditary shields to malaria and also the prior seasoning to yellow fever. So it's an unfortunate part of, I guess, the mosquitoes, influence of history, obviously, because the African slave trade is one of the most horrific events in human history.
And then the Civil War, malaria and yellow fever end up playing a role there. Can you talk about that?
Well, the American Civil War is a two-pronged mosquito influence, if you will. So at the beginning of the war, specifically 1862, the Union forces coming from the north, obviously, where there is not endemic malaria. There's certain epidemics of malaria in the northern states, but not to the extent that malaria exists or is endemic across the Confederacy. So what happens is the Union launches assaults into Confederate territory in 1862, specifically against Vicksburg, against the Mississippi, along the Mississippi River. And there, those forces are cut to pieces by malaria. And then General McClellan's Peninsula Campaign in between the York and James Rivers, which is essentially marshland, to try to capture Richmond in 1862 as well. And his troops suffer greatly from malaria. And obviously both campaigns fail in 1862, prolonging the war in what was supposed to be a short war, allowing Lincoln to add another war aim on top of just preserving the Union, which included the economic integrity of the United States. By 1863, because the war is prolonged with the failure of these campaigns in 1862, Lincoln adds the emancipation of slaves and the abolition of slavery as another primary war aim. And in the final year of the war, quinine, which is the anti-malarial of the time period, the Anaconda Plan, which is the Union naval blockade and stranglehold of the Confederacy, really starts to take effect. And the Confederacy is short, drastically short of all supplies, which includes quinine. And just to give you an idea, by 1865, an ounce of quinine cost $600 in the Confederacy, which speaks to, you know, the small quantities of quinine, but also its demand in the Confederacy, whereas the Union is absolutely stockpiled with quinine. So in the final year of the war, you start to see malaria rot away the combat effectiveness of the Confederate forces, whereas the malaria rates in the Union are less because of their stockpiles of quinine.
Talking to Timothy Weingard, author of the new book, The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. Let's bring on a caller now. Tim is with us in Marinette. Tim, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to let Timothy know that I had recently read about a young scientist, a professor in electrical engineering, that had invented some kits, plastic kits he made, that if you put body fluid in them, they'll detect diseases with a smartphone, things like malaria, dung fever, they'll test water quality, and he's thinking about these third world countries where, you know, they're hundreds or thousands of miles away from a lab. And these kits, they're little plastic kits.
Interesting.
That are cheap, and they detect nanoparticles with gold receptors.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. And Timothy, that speaks to malaria is not just a force in human history, it's a force in human nowadays. Can you talk about malaria in the world of 2019?
Well, the mosquito is still far and away our deadliest predator, and that includes humans. It's number one, and humans are a distant second, and creatures of Hollywood lore like sharks and wolves are way down the list, roughly 10 deaths a year on average caused by those animals. So Hollywood's got it completely wrong. I don't see them making horror movies about mosquitoes quite yet, but it's by still far and away our deadliest predator. And malaria is unfortunately the pervasive killer. Now, there's good news and bad news. Progressively since the year 2000, and certainly due in part to the wonderful efforts of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, we've seen malaria rates be reduced across the world every year. So malaria rates are falling every year, which is certainly a good thing. But on the other hand, what we're seeing is the emergence or reemergence of other mosquito-borne diseases. Now, thankfully, these aren't as prolific killers as malaria is. But so, for example, dengue is making a huge comeback, West Nile, Zika. So we're seeing the emergence or reemergence of other mosquito-borne diseases while malaria rates are certainly falling. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. In fact, I was reading a few articles the other day that said 4 billion people on the planet currently are at risk of dengue alone. And that's more than half the population. There's roughly 7.7, 7.8 billion people on the planet. So when you think 4 billion people are at risk of dengue alone, that's quite shocking, and that doesn't include all the other diseases. So it's a bit of a spider web. So malaria rates reduced, but emerging and other re-emerging mosquito-borne disease as are on the increase, including the southern United States, where we've seen domestic cases of Zika, dengue, and chikungunya in Florida and Texas in recent years. So it is a concern, and the mosquito is generally a universal animal. Then she inhabits every corner of the planet except for Iceland and Antarctica. So it's a universal creature with becoming universal diseases, and it requires a universal solution at the end of the day.
And Timothy, I want to touch on one more story you tell. We thought we had a solution called DDT. There were a lot of environmental concerns about its indiscriminate use. But why did we stop using DDT on large scales against mosquitoes?
Well, DDT, if we for a second just put aside the environmental degradation and its effects on other animals, including humans, and its you know, cancer agents and cancer causing of human beings. If we just look at DDT that was, you know, tried, tested, and true coming out of the Second World War, it was a miraculous mosquito killer. Mosquito-borne disease rates were slashed across the planet with the use of DDT, and it certainly saved countless lives. The problem is, depending on the mosquito species, they evolved and adapted very quickly, anywhere from 2 years to 20 years, to become immune to DDT. So by the time Rachel Carson writes and publishes her seminal work, Silent Spring, in 1962, there's mosquito populations across the planet that are already immune to DDT. So the banning of DDT has more to do with its ineffective use against mosquitoes than anything Rachel Carson wrote or some environmental political clout. It just simply didn't work anymore. And what's also important to mention about DDT is it was made commercially available to farmers in 1946. It wasn't the surgical use of DDT with residual spraying against mosquitoes that created such environmental problems. It was the actual carpet, you know, blanketing of the planet, or as Joni Mitchell says, paving paradise with DDT from an agricultural standpoint, that created so much environmental problems to other animals, including human beings. But it just simply didn't work anymore.
Timothy, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing these stories with us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
That's Timothy Weingard, professor of history and political science at Colorado Mesa University, author of the new book we've been talking about, The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator.